Our next case is 2019-284 and 2019-453, Malika Evans versus Akron General Medical Center et al. Sullivan?
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court, Chief Justice, Justices, Counsel. My name is Brian Sullivan, and I have the pleasure of representing Akron General Medical Center this morning. With the court's permission, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal. For over 30 years, Ohio law has been clear that an underlying requirement in a negligent hiring, supervision, or retention claim against an employer is an employee's individual liability for a tort or a guilt of a claimed wrong. This court has stated that if no action can be maintained against the employee, it is, quote, obvious, close quote, that any imputed actions against the employer are untenable. This requirement accurately reflects the derivative nature of a negligent hiring, retention, and supervision claim, and affirms that liability against the employer is tethered to the employee's tortious or criminal conduct.
Counselor, but hasn't this court also said that negligent hiring retention claims are different from that of those of vicarious liability of an employer for an employee wrongdoing?
They are, Your Honor. They are separate and distinct from vicarious claims that arise in the context of an employment relationship where a plaintiff seeks to vicariously impose liability on an employer for the acts of its employees that happen within the course and scope of employment. In a negligent hiring, retention, and supervision claim, the conduct of the employee that is issue is outside the course and scope of employment. And according to this court's decision in Strock versus Presnell, requires both a derivative component of liability, underlying liability of the employee, and a direct component concerning the employer's liability.
Why underlying liability? And I'm assuming you're saying liability under the legal context of having been found legally culpable.
Yes, Your Honor. Because that's what this court said in Strock versus Presnell in 1988. In that case, in the Strock case, the court concluded that in order to maintain a negligent hiring, supervision, or retention claim, an underlying requirement needed to be satisfied. And the underlying requirement that needed to be satisfied was individual liability in tort of the employee or guilt of a claimed wrong. The court concluded that if no action against the employee can be maintained, then it is obvious that any imputed action against the employer was untenable. This decision recognizes both the derivative nature of a negligent hiring and supervision claim and the direct nature of a negligent hiring and supervision claim. So yes, the employer's conduct certainly is relevant, and to the extent that they've failed to reasonably take actions to prevent an incompetent employee from causing harm to a third party. But that harm needs to be actionable under Ohio law. The employee's conduct needs to be actionable under Ohio law as a predicate to establish the liability of the employer.
Okay, so actionable doesn't necessarily mean liability, though.
Well, again, the phrases that were used by this court in Strock versus Presnell were that the individual has to be liable in tort or guilty of a claimed wrong.
I have a little bit of a problem that we're parsing the language of a case like it's a statute, but let's go with guilt of a claimed wrong. I mean, it's certainly sensible to say that someone's guilty of a crime but was never prosecuted for it. That's something that some people say all the time.
And it is our position that the phrases liable for tort or guilty of a claimed wrong are terms of art. And in the legal vernacular, they require a determination of liability. And the interpretation of those phrases can't be divorced from the sentence that immediately follows that, which says that no action can be maintained against an employer unless the underlying requirements, the legal liability in tort or the guilt of a claim wrong, have been satisfied.
But don't those very words go against the distinction between vicarious liability or respondeat superior on behalf of the employer. For instance, if the employee is deceased before some judgment of guilt or liability can happen or leaves the country, you're saying that the plaintiff can never establish a negligent hiring claim against the employer.
I'm saying that under Strzok versus Presnell and its progeny, that if an action cannot be maintained against an employee for the employee's wrongful conduct, then that is a fatal flaw in the plaintiff's ability to pursue a negligent supervision claim against an employer.
But do you derive from that there has to be an adjudication of liability?
I derive from that there needs to be a determination.
Okay. Strzok involved, the employee at issue involved a consensual relationship between someone who was supposed to be giving counseling, and the court looked at that and said there's no actionable cause against the employee. So, but if you take a hypothetical where someone commits a battery, are you saying that you have to pursue a criminal case against someone or a civil case against someone and have them adjudicated? And if you don't do that, you can never pursue a negligent hiring claim.
So that is certainly part of plaintiff's argument in this case, that there doesn't need to be an underlying determination, and this is what the Ninth District Court of Appeals relied upon as well. There simply needs to be an allegation of wrongful conduct that's recognized under Ohio law as wrongful. And we submit that misinterprets and misapplies what this court said in Strzok. The Strzok decision requires that an action has to be able to be maintained against the employee in order for there to be liability against the employer. Whether that action is in the civil context and there's a determination that the employee is liable in tort, or whether it's in the criminal context and the employee's...
So in this case, there is the... I think you can see there's the possibility that criminal conduct could be maintained against the employee or a criminal case.
As it relates to the facts of this case?
Correct.
I do not. It was stipulated below in the trial court that there was no expectation of a prosecution or criminal charges being brought against the doctor.
But that does not mean that there can't be.
It was also stipulated that the criminal case was closed and that the plaintiff stipulated that for purposes of trial, there was no dispute that this physician would not be, that this physician was not criminally liable for the conduct he allegedly engaged in.
Okay, so thereby, for purposes of this litigation, foreclosing criminal responsibility and then being outside the statute of limitations for civil.
Right, and that was the position that was advanced, one of the positions that was advanced in front of the trial court, that because plaintiffs had failed to timely pursue a civil claim against the physician, and because criminal prosecution was foreclosed, they failed to satisfy the essential requirements, the underlying requirements, as articulated by this court in Strzok.
What if Strzok just was a little fast and loose with its words? What if indeed, the language that you refer to or that you rely upon in Strzok, we determined did not mean an actual adjudication of liability or guilt?
Well, I think what Strzok memorializes is a recognition that a claim for negligent hiring, training, and supervision is in part derivative and has to arise out of the liability of the wrongdoer. The underlying wrong...
Well, okay, but take that point, though. So we have said that an injured party from respondent superior can sue either the servant or the master, or both, but can do either one. I mean, if that's the case, and there's no requirement of a prior adjudication of liability in a respondeat superior case, why would there be one in a negligent hiring case?
So the court did make that pronouncement in Lucido versus Cruz in 1940, a case that involved an effort to satisfy a judgment, and the court looked at the issue of whether or not payment by the master, in that case, precluded recovery by the servant, in that case. And the court concluded that it didn't. You know, this court in both Comer versus Risco and in National Union versus Worth recognized that in cases involving certain professionals, in those two cases, a doctor who was an independent contractor in a hospital, and in the Worth case, a lawyer whose law firm was being sued for the lawyer's malpractice, this court in both of those cases concluded that absent liability of the wrongdoer, of the doctor in Comer or the lawyer in Worth, the plaintiff's claims against the hospital or the law firm were precluded. And so although those cases deal with vicarious liability, the principle is equally applicable in the context of a negligent hiring.
Isn't it different in that in vicarious liability, you're liable for someone else's tort, and here it's a separate tort? That seems very different.
It is different in that context, but it's important to keep in mind that the negligent hiring claim is both direct and derivative. And it is that point that was made manifestly clear in the Strzok decision that requires a determination of liability or wrongdoing by the employee. And this concept that a claim has a dual nature, in part direct and in part derivative, is not novel. We see that in the context of other...
But why does requiring a determination of wrongdoing by the employee require that person be able to be sued within the statute of limitations? Those seem like two separate things. Someone can be found to have committed a wrong without being subject to a suit.
Because the employee's conduct is the actual instrument of injury. And because the employee's conduct is the actual instrument of injury, it's inextricably linked with the employer's conduct. If the employer is going to be held liable for failing to supervise an employee who outside the course and scope of employment committed an offense, that employee must be liable for the harm which he caused in order to prevent the employer from being responsible.
Counselor, but there's nothing to say explicitly he must be held responsible in a court of law. Is there?
Well, I would, again, it goes back to parsing the...
But, those I mean, I know what you said about Worth. Absent the employee's liability in the law firm case, the employer is not responsible. But, again, that was vicarious liability. And here we have a cause of action that, in essence, says that the employer was negligent for the hiring, training, or supervision. That is... a negligence, a tort that belongs to the employer, correct?
It is, Your Honor. And I would submit that to the extent the conduct that proper supervision was intended to avoid is not actionable, then the employer cannot be liable for negligent supervision.
Okay, going back to, and I don't know that I heard a comprehensive answer to the question of what happens if the employee passes away before any action in a court of law can be taken against that employee.
Sure. I think under those circumstances, the plaintiff would have a cause of action against the estate of the employee and could seek to have a determination made that the employee is liable in tort for the conduct that they engaged in prior to their death. I don't see that the employee's death is a...
All right. Well, what happens if there is no estate, or I mean, let's do a different scenario. The employee absconds from the jurisdiction and is in a place without, you know, the ability to be
served,
brought back, sued, whatever.
Sure. So I would submit that there's a mechanism or a process in place by which a plaintiff could attempt to pursue an employee, even though they've left the state, or they may have difficulty identifying who it was or where they are. And certainly to the extent that employee has absconded from the state or is absent for the state, that may be a basis to serve to toll the statute of limitations as it relates to pursuing a claim against them. So I don't see these as obstacles to prohibiting a plaintiff from successfully navigating a claim for negligence.
Mr. Sullivan, let's get back then to Strzok. There are several cases in the appellate courts across the state that talk about the elements that you need to prove for negligent hiring, retention, et cetera. How do you reconcile that case law, which is pretty prevalent and undisturbed, with Strzok? Because those elements setting forth a negligent hiring or retention claim does not preclude, does not require legal liability imposed on the employee.
So, curiously, this court has never defined the elements of a negligent supervision, hiring, or retention claim. Certainly, I think the body of case law from the appellate districts is rather consistent as it relates to setting forth the five elements. The trial court analyzed this, and the Court of Appeals analyzed this under the second element of an employee's incompetence. And the trial court determined that an employee who's not liable in tort or guilty of a claimed wrong is not incompetent as it relates to that element of the tort that the plaintiff must present evidence of to successfully pursue.
Well, and essentially, I mean, in this case, the facts of this case, I don't know whether incompetence would come into play as more so element number four, the employee's act or omission causing the plaintiff's injuries. So, and notably, in that element, it is employee's act or omission, not employee's liability or criminal culpability.
Right. And again, we would submit that the case that this court has spoken on as it relates to negligent supervision is the Strzok case, which more clearly specifies, again, that an action has to be maintained, that there be an underlying requirement of liability in tort or guilt of a claimed wrong in order for there to be a claim against the employer. I see that my time has expired. To the extent I have any additional time, I'd like to reserve that for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Chief Justice O'Connor, Justices, may it please the Court. The issue presented by defendant appellant concerns the interpretation of Strzok versus Presnell, this Court's 1988 decision. The defendant appellant's argument requires this court to find that Strzok affected a substantive change in the Ohio law of negligent retention and supervision. This requires a very broad reading of Strzok. Such a reading, however, is not compelled by the language in Strzok, and it's not intended by the court if you read the particular language relied upon by defendant and appellant in context. The underlying claims in Strzok.
Well, counsel,
yes.
The language that I find problematic in Strzok is, in this quote, an underlying requirement in actions for negligent supervision and negligent training is that the employee is individually liable for a tort or guilty of a claimed wrong against a third person, who then seeks recovery against the employer. The specificity that the employee is individually liable for a tort or guilty of a claimed wrong seems to indicate to me that Strzok intended that there be some designation of this guilt or liability in a tort.
Your Honor, this sentence in Strzok follows a fairly lengthy and extensive analysis of the claims that the plaintiff had brought in that case against the individual, the pastor, the perpetrator, who had the intimate relationship with the plaintiff's wife. So the court, in the context of this sentence, the court had gone through and analyze each of these claims, finding that they were facsimiles of amatory claims, which had been abolished under Ohio law, such as alienations of affections, go through each of these claims and finds that this plaintiff does not have a cause of action. None of these, he's asserting legal rights that don't exist as against the pastor.
So, Counselor, wait a minute. Sorry, are you saying that then the language that we're talking about here only applies to negligent hiring under these set of facts, the facts in the Strzok case?
That is what I'm saying, Your Honor, because the set of facts in Strzok were facts where the employee did not have, or the plaintiff did not have a claim, a legally cognizable claim against the employee. There was no compensable injury that the plaintiff was claiming. The plaintiff in this case, in Strzok, was claiming that the individual defendant had a consensual, intimate relationship with his wife. That's, who were consenting adults. That was not a legally cognizable claim. That's the entire analysis of the court in Strzok addresses that point.
How is that different from there not being any legal liability found and recovery from, in this case, the doctor? Because if the doctor had been sued, there might have been a finding of no liability. Or had the doctor been criminally prosecuted, there may have been a finding of not guilty. So I guess I don't read Strzok to talk about the possibility of there being liable, tortious, or criminal action, because in this scenario we find ourselves here, if the employee is sued, there could be no liability. Or if the employee is prosecuted, there can be no guilt. What does that do to the negligent hiring claim?
If there was a determination, either criminally or civilly, that there was a legally cognizable claim and the employee was absolved or found not guilty or not liable, then that would essentially negate the claim against the employer.
Is that correct?
In those set of circumstances. Nope.
Why would that be so? If he's found not guilty in a criminal case where the standard is beyond a reasonable doubt, in a negligent hiring claim, they still have to prove the wrongdoing that occurred. It's an element of the claim, but they just have to prove it by a preponderance of the evidence, right?
You're correct, Your Honor. I was really thinking of the tort situation. Correct.
Let's look at the tort situation, okay, then. If you get duty, breach, injury in fact, proximate cause, damages, right?
Yes.
And if you lost the underlying tort case in the negligent hiring case, you could never show proximate cause or damage, right? If you lost the underlying tort case.
That's correct.
But so then you have to show the underlying tort to win the negligent hiring case, don't you?
You have to prove one of the elements of your claim is the act of the employee. You have to prove that act.
Well, why is it correct then? Why do you agree with Justice Fischer's comment over here? Sorry. Why do you agree with Justice Fischer's comment that if in a civil context, the doctor in this case, if he were sued civilly and found not liable, why does that extinguish the claim for negligent hiring?
Well, because I think under principles of collateral estoppel, because there's been a judicial determination that the employee is not liable in a case that was brought by the same plaintiff.
But on the same set of facts, if the hospital in this case knew that there was a prior history of sexual assaults, let's say with the physician in this case, knew about it, brought him into the hospital anyway, and if the only evidence that's presented is the fact that they knew about this, brought him into the hospital, and the alleged victim in this case testified as to what happened, why wouldn't that be enough to prevail on a negligent hiring claim?
If the plaintiff sues the employee and the employer, and the employee for sexual battery, if a jury were to determine that the sexual battery did not happen on a preponderance of evidence, then that negates an element of the plaintiff's claim against the employer, because one of the elements of negligent supervision or retention is that there be an act of the of the employee causing injury to the plaintiff.
So you're saying a jury's finding of not having proof by a preponderance of the evidence in one case stops another trier of fact from finding it in it. So then you're saying that they are intricately entwined, that another trier of fact couldn't find negligent hiring based on knowing about a history of assault on women, bringing a physician in who has this, and letting because it could be that the first jury didn't believe the victim, and a second jury might believe the victim. But you say legally that there'd be an estoppel.
Well, you're assuming there's two separate cases. I think in a typical case, one case would have been brought against the employee and the employer, and then if the jury makes a determination that the sexual battery did not happen, then that would that's a crossover element. I would consider. If there's separate cases, then there wouldn't be collateral estoppel until there's a judgment in the in favor of the employee in that case. So the other case would proceed, with the elements that plaintiff's required to prove, and the plaintiff could prove that the employee committed that act, irrespective of what was going on in the separate case against the employee.
Counsel, is in that situation where you have separate civil actions, is the doctor a necessary party to the case? I mean, from a practical perspective, how will your case proceed?
The doctor is not a necessary party because the tort of negligent supervision retention is an independent tort.
But if you have to show that the act happened, that the misconduct happened, I guess answer that question. Do you think that within, if the doctor's not there, you say there's not a necessary party, what is it that you're going to show with respect to this conduct?
The plaintiff has the burden of proof. It needs to prove that the act occurred and that it caused injury to the plaintiff. That's the case whether the doctor or the employee or is a party or is not a party. It doesn't really make a difference in terms of what the plaintiff has to present for the plaintiff's case. So the employee is not a necessary party, particularly not in a negligent supervision or retention case. Are there any other questions at this time? Just a couple of things I also want to point out. I mean, we haven't addressed the notion of what happens with the statute of limitations. The statute of limitations for a negligence claim, for a claim of personal injury, is 2 years in Ohio. And the tort of negligent supervision retention is a independent negligence tort. The gravamen of the claim is negligence. You need to prove that the employer had actual constructive notice of the danger of foreseeable harm and failed to respond. What the defendant appellant's interpretation of the law would do is essentially change a statute. It would impose a one-year statute of limitations on this particular claim, applying the sexual battery statute of limitations, basically by infusing the two claims and conflating respondeat superior and negligent supervision and retention, which is improper. And The important point here is that there's a very substantive change that the defendant panel argues was affected by Strzok. That change just doesn't withstand, that argument doesn't withstand scrutiny once you look at the Strzok case in its entirety, and the effect that results if you impose this, what's been referred to in the briefs as a gatekeeping requirement that was never before stated in any other cases of negligent retention or supervision, that suddenly you impose this requirement of a adjudication against the employee or criminal guilt, and the argument is that the Strzok court did that with really out any discussion of such a change and what it would mean in the jurisprudence of Ohio. If there's nothing else.
Yeah, on Strzok, if I'm trying to remember it correctly, one of the reasons that reached that decision is that the causation really was the wife having a consensual relationship with the pastor, correct?
That is correct.
So there couldn't be causation because she agreed to it.
Yes, but there were certain torts that existed at one point in Ohio law where that would be a claim.
I'm throwing those away. I'm just talking about the negligence. Is it couldn't be negligent because she agreed to it.
Right.
Intervening cause or whatever.
Right. If the underlying act that causes injury is not something that's a legal wrong, then how can there be
a claim for breach of duty?
Liability as a result, whether it be the employee or the employer. That's all Strzok is holding. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Counselor, you've used your time. You may take a minute.
Thank you. Plaintiff's position and the rationale of the Court of Appeals below is premised upon an argument that the negligent hiring claim is solely independent. That argument can't be squared with the Strzok decision and the language included within the Strzok decision. For the reasons that it is undisputed that the physician involved in this case cannot be individually liable in tort or guilty of a claim wrong, the plaintiff has failed to establish under Strzok that which is required to pursue a negligent supervision claim. And for those reasons, the judgment in favor of the hospital entered by the trial court should be affirmed.
Thank you.
Thank you,
gentlemen. We'll take the matter under advisement, and you will be notified of our decision. Marcia, will you call a recess?